The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI, or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words, loosely paraphrased from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm GTR of the Nation, which is the sponsor of the podcast. And those words actually have a particular resonance this week because they were quoted by New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani in reference to AIPAC, and that caused a little bit of controversy. And was used as a bludgeon against them with, it seems like, very little effect because Mamdani is right now more powerful than ever. There were a series of elections in New York and a slate of candidates that he had supported won, and won surprisingly because as many of them were younger, newer candidates going after officials who had were either incumbents or had very strong establishment support. This has a lot of implications for not just New York City, but the changing politics of the Democratic Party. And to talk about all this, I'm very happy to have on Ross Barkin, who wrote about this for The Nation, and I'll link to that. He has other connections to this story. He's author of the book The Revolutionary, about the mayor of New York. And also, for full disclosure, he had once run for public office, and Mamdani had served as his campaign advisor. So first of all, Ross, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me on. Very excited to be here.
Yeah, no, it was an exciting night. And, you know, usually on this podcast, we deal with bad news. But I think for many of our listeners, what happened will be actually quite good news and quite unexpected news in a lot of ways. But do you want to, first just run around what exactly happened and why were so many people taken by surprise and are now treating it like it's a political earthquake?
So Zoran Mamdani, mayor of New York City, endorsed 3 congressional candidates, 2 of whom were in very difficult races, either against the traditional political establishment or an incumbent or both. All 3 won. 2 of them were DSA candidates, Claire Valdez and Darylisa Avila Chevalier, and unabashedly pro-Palestine, unabashedly in the left, Brad Lander, who defeated Dan Goldman, who's an Israel hawk, not a DSA candidate, but also very much progressive, will be one of the progressive Jewish voices in Congress. So Mamdani's slate swept, and in addition, almost every DSA candidate won down the ballot for state legislative races. Some Mamdani did endorse, some he did not. But either way, it was a tremendous night for him, for the left broadly in New York City, and the hand of the socialists in Albany, the state capital, is much strengthened, and now the number of DSA members in Congress is increasing by quite a bit, and also the number of pro-Palestine voices are unapologetically that way. And for Zoran Mamdani, this was really a demonstration of his political strength, especially with the Valdez and Avila Chevalier wins. Those showed that he was able to muscle across the finish line 2 candidates that without him might not have been nearly as competitive.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think both of those should be really regarded as sort of like upsets, and partially because of who they were running against. I mean, as I see it, like, I think there's two different stories here, or there's several different stories, but one of the stories is the sort of decline of the old machine politics and sort of political machines that existed in New York that had a base of support within certain ethnic communities and within labor unions, and really were very effective. Those seem to be a bit on the wane, or not as strong as they once were. And conversely, the DSA is emerging as its own machine, as not just an activist group or lobby group, but actually like a full-time political organizing machine that can get the votes out. And when you're talking about primaries where, fewer people vote, that's actually like really important. That's how you actually get your candidates to win. And particularly like when you're talking about blue districts, that basically means that's how you get people, into Congress or into Albany. So, let's dissect that a little bit. What do you think of that analysis, and particularly about the sort of decline of some of these older machines?
They've declined drastically. I've argued political machines do not exist in New York City anymore, not certainly what they were in the 20th century. There are organizations like the Brooklyn Democratic Party and the Queens Democratic Party and the Bronx Democratic Party, but beyond controlling patronage in the judicial system, which is still very much a problem, they do not have a great say over electoral politics. Now, of course, they endorse winners, they're non-competitive races, but there is no such thing as a machine that has political clubs teeming with people who are going to go out and knock on doors, who are going to do the very unglamorous work of getting someone elected. The only machine now is DSA. They don't have control of the same patronage lines, even with the mayor, but they are the only real organization that is doing the classic political work that Tammany Hall once did and its successors once did. What happened in New York for a long time, you had the fall, the decline of the machines, you had a reform movement. And then for a while, you had what I now think of as an organizing interregnum, where just the establishment was coasting on lack of opposition. And that really started to shift after 2016, first with the rise of AOC defeating Joe Crowley, who's the boss of the Queens Democratic Party. That kicked off an insurgency that continues. And now a lot of people on the left, a lot of young people have realized the establishment is a paper tiger. It has money, sure, but now Zoran Mamdani has money too. DSA can raise money. And they don't do much else. There used to be this real coalition building among these political machines, among ethnic groups, in concert with labor unions, in concert with very active political clubs. And these clubs have all atrophied, and the club culture has moved into DSA. If you are a young person who wants to get involved in politics in New York, you join DSA, and that's why their membership now has increased. It was on a bit of an ebb before Mamdani. Now it has gone up dramatically, and it's going to continue to go up with these victories.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's good to like underscore what you're saying in terms of like the actual old machines, like when they were really robust, they were like an entire social world. They were, as you said, they were like clubs, and they were able to like organize people and then provide benefits for people. This would be like how, if you don't have many other things going for you, you're economically marginalized, socially marginalized, the machines were ways of becoming integrated into societies. It could help you like get jobs or get connections. And like that whole social world has kind of disappeared. And in some ways, DSA is a real like interesting anomaly or new development of like it's more like a sort of like a European ideological party, which also does have some of that, as you say, social function. Like, I don't think it's an accident that, like, you know, its membership skews heavily young. Those are people who have the ability to, you know, go out, go to meetings. And it's sort of in some ways like the replacement of that sort of social world that has disappeared.
Very much so. And my mother grew up in Brooklyn when she was young, you know, in her 20s and 30s. She belonged to a political club. It was a reform club. You know, you had like in the 70s and 80s, both the establishment clubs and those that were somewhat anti-establishment. But either way, they were absolutely places where young people went to make friends, find jobs, date. My mom speaks very fondly about the storefront clubhouses, a lot of nostalgia for them. And they really withered by, I would say, the 21st century. You saw, you know, politics lose a lot of that organizing glue. And from, you know, from probably the dawn of the 21st century into the 2010s, you saw some political organizing from labor unions. The Working Families Party in its foundation in its early years did a lot of political organizing, but there wasn't much else. And the machine bosses themselves got very self-satisfied and lazy. And Joe Crowley, who was felled by AOC, was the embodiment of that. He did not live in the district. He lived in Virginia. He had never competed in an election before, a serious one. He did not know what it was like to actually have to go court voters. As you said, the old machines, whether it was Tammany, whether it was the machines out in Brooklyn, and within the machines too, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, diversity, different ethnic organizations, different neighborhood organizations too, and they all really fell off. And DSA has really brought a lot of it back. And you see this ossified, quite frankly, lazy establishment act very smug or entitled and now somewhat shocked. And they left a vacuum and it was filled. DSA is filling it. And so if they want to win elections, they have to do that kind of work. And they're not. Hakeem Jeffries will be the next Speaker of the House, most likely. And I would not say he's in danger of losing necessarily, but he was lucky that Zoran Mamdani helped dissuade a leftist challenger to him last year in order to build a better working relationship with the governor. Because if that challenger ran on Tuesday, I don't know if he would have won, but could he have gotten 40% and embarrassed Jeffries? 42%? Sure. So it's going to be really interesting to see how the establishment reacts. So far, they have not really extended the olive branch. And I think that just means that in 2 years, there will be more primaries. And this will continue. That's what happens when you get a DSA mayor who has the bully pulpit, who's got the ability to raise a lot of money, who's got the ability to campaign. The left, for the first time, certainly in my memory and probably in yours too, has a lot of leverage. My whole conception of the left, the socialist left, progressive left, has always been small bore, on the defensive, scrapping. Even with Bernie couldn't get past Hillary. Hillary ultimately had the leverage. And now she's a bit on the other foot. You know, the establishment is staring up at a mayor who will work with them because he's amiable, but he took on, in essence, two congressional incumbents, and one was retiring and her candidate was blown out by Valdez. And then Espiot, he took on very directly, to the consternation of the Hakeem Jeffries of the world. But they don't, as our president would say, they don't have the cards. Not like they used to.
Yeah.
They once did. They don't have those same cards anymore. It's a new world.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, in terms of the sort of the weakness of the establishment, I mean, I think there's like a sort of couple of factors, as you mentioned, sort of like a kind of complacency, a laziness. And particularly, like, I think in places like New York, where it's like heavily blue, where, like, you know, like once you get the sort of nomination, you don't have to do like a lot of heavy lifting necessarily. But the other aspect is, like, in terms of the how the left relates to that, I think there has been a lot of debate among the left, and there continues to be. There's still people who think this way on the issue of, you know, whether you should work within the Democratic Party or you should be forming a third party. And to my way of thinking, you know, the Democrats, like, it's not actually a party. It's like a brand. It's a label, and it's become hollowed out. And the Republicans as well. Both major political parties are hollowed out and therefore are easy for takeovers. And we saw this first with the Republicans. I mean, Donald Trump was basically this celebrity, you know, who had a brand name because of the Apprentice TV show, and that made him more well known and liked than actual Republican politicians. And this guy and his family were able to take over the Republican Party. And what we're seeing now on the Democratic side, it's a little bit different because we're actually, the DSA is a party within a party. But is because it's actually able to do the work of organizing that the establishment can't, is actually making real headway. But the other aspect of the story is Mamdani himself, that, you know, like, you know, he had the surprise victory last year. But also, he's sort of gone from strength to strength. He's like, according to all the opinion polls I've seen, he's like more popular now than ever before. And some of that is that a lot of his initial, any unpopularity he had was from people who had been told, you know, like, this guy's a scary Muslim who's going to impose Sharia law. And now we've had him for almost a year since he won the nomination. And there, as far as I can tell, there's no Sharia law in New York City. So it seems like a lot of the, you know, opposition to him has sort of like melted away, and that he's actually, like, you know, quite well liked and is seen as doing an effective job. So like, what does all this say about his, you know, current political standing in the New York political world?
His standing is very high. I mean, that can always change. Being mayor is a tough job, and there will be more controversies, and you can't predict the future. But right now, it is quite high. Unlike other mayors, he has a fan base. He has people like Trump has on his side who believe fully in him and will follow him, which is a very rare thing. Very few politicians have that. He's got an organizing base in DSA. He's an executive who cares about political organizing, who does it very well. And this is different than almost any other recent mayor. Mm-hmm. And so you take that along with an Obama-level ability to communicate, to speak, to give speeches, to speak to the media, to also repel attacks in the way Romney found it difficult to pigeonhole Obama in that election. Mm-hmm. A lot of the attacks on Zohran Mamdani fall flat because of his own nimbleness, but also their inconsistency and their exaggeration. So most voters don't believe we will live under Sharia law. You look at the so-called threats to Jewish people. I'm Jewish. We are not threatened in New York City. This smear is from AIPAC, which fell flat, and other Israel advocacy groups. The old playbook does not quite work anymore, where you just spend an enormous amount of money to find your opponent and bash them in submission. I'm not saying that can't work anymore, but when you've got someone like Mamdani, who is well-established and a great communicator, and also you've got candidates who are able to cut through the noise, it makes it so that though super PACs remain pernicious, super PACs can't determine the course of events like you might have thought they could. They still matter, but Zohran Mamdani is the type of adversary that the various moderate to right-wing groups have never encountered before. Someone of Obama's talent level, Trump's outsider status, and a leftist core that is different than most politicians who reach this station, typically they're at most an Obama, someone you describe as center left and holding rather conventional views on most issues. And I'm not saying Zoran Mamdani doesn't hold conventional views also. Hmm. What I'm saying is he has a core, certainly on issues of foreign policy, certainly on his views of specifically uplifting the working class, that put him in opposition to a lot of establishment politicians. So he's unique.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's very young, unlike Bernie.
Oh, I wanted to pick up on that Obama comparison, because I do actually think there's a lot of similarities, but with one crucial difference, which is Obama had created, or he, you know, his people had created, this enormous machine to elect him. Obama for America, 2008, which was able to organize a lot of people that were, like, you know, totally outside the political system, and not only won him, one of the greatest landslides that the Democrats have had in, like, many decades, but also, like, you know, like, win states like Indiana, and but once Obama was elected, one of the first things that they did was to, like, dismantle that organizational infrastructure, because he did not want to be beholden to the people who had brought him into power. And he wanted, to have a free hand as an executive. Mamdani is, like, that's a crucial distinction with Obama. Like, he got into office and he has not dismantled the sort of organization structure. He's, in fact, trying to strengthen it. And through this election, he has, like, enormously empowered it. So that's something that one does not really actually see a lot of, like a politician that, like, continues to organize. Yeah, Trump might be somewhat similar. Like, he continues to, like, do Trump continue to do rallies after he's elected.
Trump is, funnily enough, almost similar in that way, where there's not, like, a MAGA and DSA, putting aside ideology, are organizationally different. But yes, Donald Trump continued campaigning the minute he was out of power, and while he was in office, I mean, he's almost immediately running for re-election. And of course, we know why that can be problematic.
Yeah.
But Donald Trump did very much pay attention to the grassroots and the base of the party in different ways. And Obama was not an organizer at all when he came into power, which is very true. He left nothing behind in terms of any organizational machinery. And he was really only useful to Democrats when he stood at the top of the ticket, and they did well. If he was not on the ticket, turnout fell, and there wasn't much there for the rest of the party. And we saw what happened in 2016. And DSA both precedes Zoran. He did not invent DSA, as we know. It goes back to the 1980s. And DSA was vibrant. He joined DSA. He was uplifted by them. But it's a symbiotic relationship where they are both independent of him, but very much a part of him, and he strengthens them by being who he is in elected office, especially as long as he maintains a certain level of popularity and competence. It is, for DSA, rocket fuel having someone like this. Bernie Sanders reinvigorated DSA. It was very important for DSA. But he's not a member of DSA. He's not cadre to the organization the way Zoran Mamdani is. So they relate very differently to DSA. DSA is a part of Zoran's organizational machinery in the way it's not quite with Bernie. Bernie has Our Revolution. Our Revolution was somewhat of a failure, to be frank. I think Bernie has a lot of good organizational instincts, and you can say a lot of kind words with the oligarchy tour and what he's doing for candidates, but there isn't quite a independent, quasi-independent Bernie Sanders organization that's doing terribly vital work or is essential in any way, whereas DSA is very different. And having a mayor who is very much a member of the organization and cares about the organization's future and has members of DSA in his administration, that is very different. That is new, and that is a weapon at their disposal.
Yeah, and I know we're talking about New York, but I just wanted your thoughts on DSA candidates in other places where it might not be as strong, but seem to have been doing well during this moment. I think of Washington, D.C., Los Angeles. Like, there does seem to be something going on there where, like, there's enough of a anti-establishment mood. And, like, well, what's your sense in terms of, like, you know, can the DSA... You know, can this model be nationalized? Can it be taken elsewhere?
Definitely. I mean, DSA has chapters throughout the country and has won many elections in other cities, both large and small. I know, you know, Twin Cities has an active DSA chapter. Certainly the next Washington, D.C. mayor will be a DSA member. You have in L.A. the potential of a DSA member winning. So DSA in some ways has gone national. Now, it still has a long way to go. I mean, it has nationally maybe now 100,000 members. I have to check. I forget, which is significant, but not overwhelming. And certainly it's not clear yet that DSA can win beyond blue areas, you know, or areas that are very Democratic. We don't know what the swing state factor of DSA is, but while one can say they have a long way to go and may not ever become a truly dominant national organization, it would be foolhardy to put a peak on their ability to appeal, because Zoran Mamdani alone is a refutation of that. I mean, anyone who tells you they thought in 2024 New York City could elect a DSA member in 2025 and he would be a Muslim, they're lying. And, you know, you have this line of attack, you know, from some centrist pundits who look at him and go, well, of course it's New York City. Of course they elected a DSA member. New York City would be one of the 15 largest states in America if it were a state. And while it is very Democratic, it has a wide range of ideologies. It has a borough that supports Trump in Staten Island. And it also has many different types of Democrats. So it's not a straightforwardly leftist city. Nevertheless, Zoran Mamdani won. So that was already one bit of conventional wisdom that was defied completely. So while I don't know how far DSA can go, I hesitate to declare, as some might, that it can't win in X place or it has no hope here. You don't know until you try, and you don't know what form movements take.
Yeah, I wanted to actually take up that, because I feel it's a centrist cope to say, well, that's New York. As you mentioned, you know, the population is actually quite large, but also, like, New York, you know, you look at, like, recent mayors, like Rudy Giuliani had been mayor, Michael Bloomberg had been mayor, Eric Adams had been mayor. So it's not a place where the left always wins. So this sort of, like, attempt to belittle what has actually been achieved is not very persuasive. I wanted to think a little bit more in terms of the role that Israel is playing, which you had alluded to earlier. Because it seems to me that that's become actually a very potent web issue tied up with all sorts of other questions about the role of money in power. And it's a way in which sort of DSA Democrats distinguish themselves from their opponents, and including opponents that were, like, you know, they're not, like, right-wing opponents. These were actually, you know, left liberal opponents, but which were beholden to AIPAC. So in what way has this sort of, like, Israel issue and AIPAC issue really become a very important wedge?
To me, it's not so different than how the Vietnam War was a wedge in the 1960s. And a lot of reform candidates in Democratic primaries were anti-Vietnam. And that sent a wave of young politicians into office. The war in Gaza perhaps doesn't quite have the same salience, but it's also not that far off. One's views on the Middle East are now certainly important, and it matters to a lot of young voters, especially, that you are pro-Palestine. And it's not irrational to be that way. The American government has been in hock to Israel for many decades. Israel has moved far to the right. The devastation in Gaza, the genocide, has been one of the more awful things to watch in modern times. And so it makes sense that people will be galvanized by it. And for DSA, which has always been anti-Israel, pro-Palestine since at least 2017, they were at the vanguard. So DSA and DSA candidates have a certain credibility in that they didn't pivot to the issue. The issue mattered for a while. And for someone like Zoran Mamdani, being a pro-Palestine mayor, being a pro-BDS mayor, that is a sea change. Would have been impossible in the 2010s. The amount of politics today that was taboo and I started writing about politics is remarkable. And the pro-Israel faction of the Democratic Party is losing quite badly and is going to keep losing. In fact, I think we're seeing a generational shift, a realignment. And in the future, you're going to have a Democratic Party that is going to be conditioning military aid and treating Israel like it would any other putative ally of the United States. And even the Republican Party, where I think a lot of the pro-Israel energy and money is going to go, I expect there in the future to be a rising faction, you know, certainly a younger wing of the party that is Israel skeptical, which is happening already. But certainly for the Democrats.
Yeah, we should mention, like, you know, Vice President J.D. Vance has been saying things about Israel that are like, you know, not from a left-wing human rights perspective, but from a America First perspective, that are quite remarkable. I mean, he said that Israeli leaders have to realize that they cannot kill their way towards solving their political problems. That is not something that one has heard from any major like American political leader for many decades. Like, it is actually
no, and it would have been unthinkable. Not since H.W. Bush was one of the last presidents who approached Israel with some degree of impartiality. I believe he was interested in conditioning aid to Israel. But since the 1990s, you've had a succession of presidents who have unstinting support for Israel. And that is changing. That will change. You see it in the Democratic primary for president, the number of candidates refusing AIPAC money who are just talking about the issue in a different way. You're seeing it now in all these elections where being pro-Palestine not only is not a pitfall, it helps you. And you're seeing the success of a mayor who's also pro-Palestine. The Overton window only shifts more, and it's why the Israel hawks are panicking. It's why you see all of these far-fetched, in my view, idiotic posts after Tuesday about how Jews aren't safe in New York. And it's ludicrous. Jews are safer in New York than they are in Israel. I don't worry about a rocket falling into my neighborhood. And it's a relatively safe American city. And they're scared.
Well, relatively safe. Like crime is actually lower in New York than it's ever been in recorded history.
Yes, very much so. It's fallen a lot. I mean, I don't want to minimize crime that does occur, but yes, it is a place you can freely walk around and feel safe and know you're safe. And the Israel faction doesn't know how to behave necessarily right now because they've never experienced anything like this before. They've never been on the defensive. They don't know what being on the defensive is like. And they don't know what it's like to have to compromise and to have to actually make an argument in the public square and not just bludgeon a candidate with money. And, you know, we're going to see what happens in the Michigan primary too, where you've got one pro-Palestine candidate who's doing very well and a top rival who is very much an Israel hawk. And already the fact that Abdul El-Sayed has gotten this far is a testament to the changing climate. And it'll be very interesting to see if he wins. But regardless, certainly in the Democratic Party, it is shifting away from Israel. That will continue as these generations age. The old nostalgia for Israel will fade away.
Yeah, no. I mean, there's been like a remarkable shift. And I'll mention, like, CNN had a poll that they just reported on yesterday that 52% of Jewish New Yorkers think that Israel has committed a genocide. And so it's like, if that, you know, so like if in New York, which is like, you know, one of the most Jewish cities outside of Israel proper, like a public opinion is in that direction among Jewish community, you know, one could imagine what it's like elsewhere. So there's been a sort of massive shift. And I think the party is having real trouble adapting to it. And that sort of brings up maybe like a sort of final thing that we can bring out, because there has actually been a freak out on the establishment. And when I think James Carville on one of the podcasts, he went on saying, you know, like, we need a schism. Like, I've had it with it, and I can't be in the same party with people like that. And you see other people talking about how they might want to give less money to the Democrats. And as you said, there's been a lot of scaremongering of people, you know, like acting like we're on the verge of pogroms in New York. Well, what's your general sense? Like, is this just theatrics, or, you know, like, do these people believe it, or how serious are their threats?
I view it as theatrics, and I view it also as the reaction of people who just aren't used to losing. Or in the past, the losing has been less stark. If you think about the defeat of Hillary Clinton, that defeat had many explanations that one rightly or wrongly could run towards. You could blame Comey, you could blame the Russians, you could blame Bernie, you could blame Jill Stein, you can blame white racists, and on we went. Here, it's the sort of thing where one side's winning elections and one side's losing it, and there is no other angle beyond the Democratic Party and its candidates are moving to the left on these issues. It doesn't mean the left is guaranteed victory all the time, but it means you have to compete. You know, the James Carvilles of the world who haven't been involved in competitive electoral politics in a real way in decades don't really know what that's like. And if you think that the DSA is unacceptable, if you think Zoran Mamdani is unacceptable, if you believe they're all hateful and anti-Semitic and anti-American, go organize in the primaries and try to beat them. We do live in a democracy, and the candidate with the most votes does win most of the time. And they're free to do that work. But shouting on cable TV, posting unhinged, you know, threads on social media, it's a loser mentality. And it's one that younger voters, and certainly those who are less keen on Democrats, are not going to take seriously. And we live in an anti-establishment time now. We have for a bit. The mood is anti-incumbent, and so it's helping the left, but you can even go beyond it too. And the Democratic Party must respond to that. And if they don't, this will keep happening.
Yeah, no, I agree with all that. I just want to underscore another aspect, which is usually the argument that liberals make to the left is that, you know, if they have candidates that the left doesn't like, it's still their responsibility in a democracy to defeat the Republican, hold their noses, and vote for the candidate. And, you know, we have a lot of rhetoric about, you know, Trump as a fascist threat, which actually I agree with. But now it seems like people like Carville and, you know, Jamie Harrison, others, are taking the opposite tack, where they're saying, like, you know, we're losing our control of the party, and we want the left to leave the party. We want, you know, we want a schism. So now they're saying, like, we don't want a Big Ten. We want a small tent. And this is, like, after they've already, like, lost to Trump twice. So they want to, like, both shrink the party as it's fighting what they see as a fascist threat. Like this seems to be something, like, radically incoherent about this politics.
It is incoherent, and it's self-serving, because you can't have it both ways. And as, you know, we said before, this is not a parliamentary system where the parties control party lists and decide who stands for office. These parties are, in essence, shell organizations that one can occupy if they bring the volunteers. Jamie Harrison's post was nonsensical because the Democratic Party, so to speak, does not have volunteers to offer. You don't go to Democratic Party headquarters and ask for 100 volunteers and $250,000 when you run for office. You go find those people yourself, even if you're an establishment candidate. So the whole thing is so stupid on its face, but luckily you just don't have to take it that seriously. Jamie Harrison doesn't have any power, doesn't even run the DNC anymore. He lost in South Carolina. James Carville hasn't mattered since the 1990s. And what matters is the outcome of elections. If they want to go out and field candidates and win, if they want to challenge Zoran Mamdani in 2029, they're free to do it. Go try to, in 2 years, run primaries against all the DSA candidates, just one in New York City. Run a primary against Claire Valdez. Run a primary against Brad Lander. Run one against Dari Lissa. They can do it. Nothing is stopping them. Let's see what happens. Because the DSA is not going to stop running primaries. Zoran Mamdani is not going to stop endorsing in primaries. If anything, this election night has emboldened them to do much more and even raise questions about, did they go far enough? Should they perhaps have primaried Hakeem Jeffries? Should they have primaried the governor, Kathy Hochul? They did not. That was Zoran Mamdani, in part, his doing. So if anything, the results of Tuesday were a confirmation that one should probably get more bold, more ambitious, and more aggressive, and defer even less, because there is a political boss in New York City now, and it's Zoran Mamdani.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Like all bosses, he's going to exert himself.
Mm-hmm. You know, he's clearly the sort of, you know, leader of a very, very strong political machine, and one that is ambitious and, like, you know, isn't happy with the power that they have, but wants
the historical antecedent for me that no one on the left wants to use, and certainly Zoran Mamdani will never use it, but I get to use it, is Huey Long. Huey Long was elected the governor of Louisiana at around the same age as Zoran. He was about 35. He was up against the Louisiana political machine, which was much more powerful than today's Democratic Party. And in a matter of 4 years, he completely broke it, built his own machine, and dragged Louisiana into the 20th century, building roads, building bridges, building schools. Of course, was problematic. Of course, had his autocratic tendencies. But that is what the left should be thinking about. How do you build durable political machines that serve working class people? Huey Long did it. There was corruption. There was a lot of patronage. But he built a machine that long outlasted him, that made Louisiana a actual left populist state, which would change with the rise of the Republican Party. So, you know, LaGuardia and FDR, obviously the antecedents we all look to, but if you want to see someone who really ran against the establishment, the big oil, big money, and beat them at their own game, it was Huey. And so I think Zoran Mamdani is on a different scale, doing something similar. And I think the DSA has the ability to do that. And they should be thinking big in those terms. How do we create our organizations that are delivering for people and can be self-sustaining and can blow the establishment out of the water?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a great analogy. And I mean, it sort of promises, like, you know, like a fundamentally new politics, so which we'll keep a track on. And I would encourage listeners to read Ross's article in The Nation, look up his book, The Revolutionary on Mamdani, because these are some of the most significant events that are happening in American politics, and I think they have wide implications for the future. So once again, Ross, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.